Welcome to the Teach Better Podcast. I'm Doug McKee.
And I'm Edward O'Neill.
And we are here to talk about teaching and learning.
On today's show, Cornell math professor Stephen Strogatz talks about helping students discover for themselves the joys and frustrations of mathematical thinking.
I see my job as trying to get someone very eager to teach themselves.
Our guest today is Stephen Strogatz from the Cornell Math Department. He's a world-renowned mathematician known primarily for his work in nonlinear dynamics and chaos theory. He's an award-winning author of Sync, The Calculus of Friendship, and my favorite, The Joy of X, which is about just how awesome math is. And he's also well-known as one of the best teachers at Cornell. And we couldn't be happier to talk to him today. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much. Edward, I see you chuckling there. Is that from The Joy of X title?
Sure is.
It's a good one. Did you come up with that one? Or is that
it's out there. I mean, it's a joke that's been out there. There's a book about like X Windows?
Yeah.
You're the CES guy, right? Yeah,
yeah.
X Windows. Somebody wrote a book, a manual for that, Joy of X.
The X Window system.
Yeah.
Right.
And I had seen it also mentioned in somebody else's math book, but they were afraid to use it as their own title. But in a footnote, they said the title, The Joy of X, is still available.
You see, there's no such thing as an original idea out there.
But today's generation doesn't particularly get the joke.
Oh, no. Of course. Right.
No.
Right.
It's,
right. Yeah. No, they don't get my Brady Bunch references either. Yeah, it's too bad. So today, I want to spend most of our time talking about how we make subjects that are traditionally dry, and I'm not saying that math is traditionally dry, but some people would. And I think the same criticism could be applied to economics and frankly, lots of other things, depending on your perspective, maybe even just about everything. And in fact, there are lots of ways we can make these subjects exciting. And I don't even want to say that we're making them exciting as much as we're identifying we're identifying what is intrinsically exciting about them and connecting it to what students already find pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that this is something that that your department actually seems to take pretty seriously, because there are signs all over campus that say Cornell Math Department. Curiosity, discovery, and creativity, which I think if you did like a little kind of a word association test, most people, those would not be their top three choices.
For math,
for math.
No.
Be like pain, misery, and boredom or something.
Yeah, we were thinking about that, but
the focus groups didn't like that one as much.
That was our old brand.
That was the old, yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, it's just as a complete tangent, because we like tangents in here. It does remind me a little bit of when I was at the University of Pennsylvania. The University Hospital had this whole branding campaign about we're there for.
We always amputate the correct limb. That was
well, maybe no. It was actually not as honest as that. It was something like, we are there for you. And it was all about how their bedside manner was really great.
Mm-hmm.
And it went terribly because nobody believed it, because it wasn't actually true.
Oh.
And so they switched to a new branding, which is, we have the smartest, best doctors.
Okay.
Which was actually pretty true. Like, they were very good.
Sure.
And so you have to be, with these branding things, like, you can't just lie. And so if it was not true that math was all about curiosity and discovery and creativity, it wouldn't work.
But well, the fact is, we don't know yet. Does it work?
Well, I don't know if it'll work.
This sign only went up recently.
But it is honest.
It's how mathematicians see themselves.
Right. Exactly.
We're not necessarily conveying that so well to everyone else.
In
the classroom or in the popular media. I mean, math is usually thought of as cold and inhuman and also very ancient.
Right.
You know, we talk a lot about Pythagoras and Archimedes, and many people think of it as a dead subject. And it's, you know, it comes as a shock to some people that there is math being created every day.
But you don't see any of that in school. I mean, the most advanced, I think, the vast majority of people in the U.S. ever get is calculus.
Yes, that's right.
And they don't see anything new I mean, the newest thing they see was developed by Newton in what year?
Yeah, around 1660 something.
So I mean,
or Leibniz.
It's pretty rational.
Sure.
Think that stuff is
400 years old doesn't make the case, or 350, but. Right. Well, that's right. So that's a mission that we have, is to try to show the contemporary aspects of the subject, as well as the wonderful classic things that were discovered.
Right. And so
the word dead there, I think, is so interesting, because I think one of the challenges about teaching math is it's a symbol system that is new to people, or it constantly has new elements. And you don't get to speak it aloud. You don't get to order food. So, I mean, if you're learning a new symbol system that's a language, you get to use it in a very functional way. So in a way, it's like Latin or Greek in a sense, and that must be enormously challenging to teach.
It can be, but on the other hand, I mean, we might benefit from low expectations. You know, everybody thinks they're going to hate this subject, and they have already 16 years of hating it before they get to us. So I think we have a lot of upside potential, as you might say, in the business world. That is, you know, so I think certainly it's been a great pleasure for me, my whole teaching career, starting from, that's a good question. When did it start? I was going to say in graduate school, but the truth is I was trying to teach people in college, my other classmates.
Helping them.
I always loved tutoring. I did that in high school.
Right.
There were times when in elementary school, I'm not saying this in a way that's going to make me sound like a likable young person. But sometimes I would notice something that I didn't agree with. I want to say my teacher was wrong, is what I'm really trying to say here.
Yes.
And I would offer to correct them, and sometimes a teacher would respond by saying, well, would you like to get up here and try to teach the class? And that wasn't the right question.
Because I would say, yes, please. I'd be happy to. Right.
And so more than once I did try.
Well, I mean, you're in some sense, you're following in great mathematicians' footsteps, because one of my favorite math stories is about Gauss. And when I heard it, it was about third grade.
Yeah, that's right. Gauss is 8 years old in that story.
Well, he gets in trouble.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell a story?
It's a traditional story that Gauss, who many mathematicians would call the greatest mathematician ever. I don't happen to say that myself because there are things I don't like about Gauss, so I want to believe less of him. But okay, that's a different story. But anyway, so young Gauss, 8 years old in Germany, is in a class which is often described as having 100 students in it, in the legend. And the teacher is looking for some rest, and he tries to give the students busy work so that he could check his email. No, probably not, because Gauss is middle 1800s. But anyway.
His postal mail.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, the teacher asks all the students to add the numbers from 1 to 100. And when they're done, they should put their slate on the desk, on the teacher's desk. You know, that was the way it was done. The slates would all be piled high. So anyway, Gauss writes the answer instantly and puts his slate on the teacher's desk after a few seconds. And the teacher assumes that it's wrong, except that the number is right. 5050. 50-50 is the sum of the numbers from 1 to 100. And the question is, you know, how did Gauss know how to do this? Obviously, he didn't add all the numbers, 1 plus 2 plus 3, the long way. But he, according to the legend, you know, later in life would tell this story. He said that he knew to do it by adding the numbers in pairs, where you take the biggest and the smallest. 1 plus 100 makes 101. Then you take the next biggest and the next smallest. 2 plus 99 also adds up to 101. And you realize that if you do things that way, you have 50 copies of numbers that add up to 101. So 50 times 101 is 50-50.
Yeah, it's a great story. And so you were also giving your teacher a hard time.
Oh, occasionally, yeah. I mean, not just in math class. I had a teacher who pronounced the country Tanzania.
Oh,
and I said, no, I think you mean Tanzania. There's Tasmania, you know, in Australia, but that country is Tanzania. Anyway,
how to make friends.
Make friends. I've stopped doing that now.
Yeah. So what I would like to know is how we can actually, because you and me, and I think most faculty, certainly the faculty that we've talked to, have a passion for their subject, and they believe it's important and interesting. And how can we efficiently, effectively, kind of transmit that passion and kind of induce that passion in our students. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've been thinking about this, and I think you can kind of divide it up into like two. One way to divide it is into like these two halves. What can we do actually in the classroom? And what can we do as far as kind of assigning work and asking them to do things outside the classroom that'll induce this kind of this passion and this curiosity? Mm-hmm. And so even in the most flipped, well, maybe not the very most flipped classrooms, there's at least a little bit of lecturing that happens. My classes range from very little to a fair amount, depending on the day or the course. But when you lecture, are there things that you do? I mean, are there obvious things like don't speak in a monotone? Don't stand in front of the board and stare at the board and just write numbers. Uh-huh. Don't read from your computer.
Yeah.
Okay? But what else do you do to kind of get students excited?
That's the art of teaching, and
I think it's a small piece.
Oh, really?
It's a really important piece, and it's a very visible piece.
Huh.
And I think in the movies, that's what people think teaching is.
Yeah.
Is getting up and kind of being exciting and rah-rah and like maybe even standing up on a desk.
Oh, well, hold on.
Kind of Dead Poets Society.
Dead Poets Society is one thing.
And I think it's a piece. I think it helps.
I think it might be a very important, if not the most important piece. I'm not saying the performance aspect, because that's one technique.
Right.
But I think the goal is to get a student to fall in love with the subject, or at least be so curious about the subject that he or she will go home and begin to teach him or herself.
That is exactly. I sort of wonder,
like, what is happening in that 50 minutes that we're together in the room in what's traditionally a lecture?
Right.
I mean, some people are such great lecturers that they can be inspiring just by virtue of their wonderful lecturing style. And then, but the question is, will the student learn the subject by just sitting there and absorbing it in those 50 minutes? I think usually not.
Almost certainly not.
So what has to happen is the student has to be so fired up that then they will, instead of saying his or her, I'll just resort to they, even though it's not right.
No, I like them.
They will...
I'm a descriptivist, not a prescriptivist.
Anyway, I see my job as trying to get someone very eager to teach themselves.
I actually think
in math, that's how it's done. I don't think that I can teach. I mean, I know this from lecturing now for 30 years, and students give me high ratings as a lecturer. And every year I see about 80 of my students not learning the subject.
Now, out of how many?
Did I say 80? I meant 80%.
Not learning the subject.
Yeah. I really think that I'm succeeding. Like, if my job is to help students learn calculus or complex analysis or differential equations or whatever, I don't think I'm a successful teacher. I think I'm a successful lecturer, and the ratings show that. The students all feel like they had a lot of fun. They learned a lot. They think they learned a lot.
They think they learned a lot.
But when I measure what they've learned by the conventional measurement of giving them tests,
you're disappointed.
I'm very, very consistently disappointed. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what to make of that.
Maybe
my tests are too hard. Maybe there's, you know, this, I'm a little embarrassed to even be saying this, but I think a lot of my colleagues, and sometimes in my darker moments, I would say there's a distribution of math ability. Mm. And you're just measuring that goddamn bell curve.
Right.
You know, that there are 20% of people who can do it. And the rest of the people, you're wasting your time with them. I don't believe this.
I do not believe
I don't want to believe this.
Right.
Although, and I think I, yeah, go ahead.
The 80-20 thing, I mean, we all know there are all these things that people believe are 80-20. I do believe that 20% of students can achieve anything you give them.
Right.
That
they're kind of
almost no matter where
resistance.
You are, they'll you give them an assignment and it can be impossible, and 20% of them are going to do it. And so
and you can teach it very, very badly. And it doesn't matter.
I find there's always about 20% A's. And then the question, you know, I feel like the question is, how do you get everyone else perhaps to get a B? You know, that's would be one way of approaching it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the goal is to shift them from where they are forward and Some people, they're not going to get to where you want them, where you would love everyone to be, but that's not a failure.
Well, I feel like I haven't really responded to the original question, which was, what are we supposed to do, in that lecture room? Are we Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams saying seize the day and, making the subject romantic and passionate? That can work for some students. I guess the answer I'd like to give is that I don't know, and therefore I'm going to try everything I can think of. That is, some students love history. Once they understand the stories of the people, the human struggle to create math, the setbacks, the rivalries, that will fire up some kids. Right. Other kids are very excited about applications. Once they can see how it can help them build a better shock absorber or a new way of searching the internet, that's it for them.
Right.
Then there are people who love logical purity. They want to understand the arguments. They want to go to the bottom of the subject and see how it's built up from scratch. And you can go on and on. There are people who like the game, the game of playing math. They want to compete and beat someone and be smarter than them or faster.
Right.
That's okay. That works for them. So there's probably like 20 different things that I could list.
But I think
I try to do all of them.
Right.
That's the hope. I'm going to push somebody's button sometime.
Right. So this is like a deep point, which is people are motivated by different things.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think, so your strategy is to just try to hit all of them.
Occasionally.
And I try to do that too.
I mean, I can't hit everyone every lecture.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to do as much as I can to keep everybody activated enough, that they're still with me, and then they're going to hopefully go home.
Everybody above a threshold.
Yeah. You might say, like, when people apply for academic jobs, there's usually a required essay that you're supposed to submit where you describe your teaching philosophy.
Right.
And mine is that I'm Catholic with a lower C. I want to try everything. I don't believe that it has to be done through applications or through group learning or through, whatever is the current mantra. I think lots of things can work.
Do you try to measure, or how large are your classes?
They vary from at the most inhumane to about 200 in a lecture on differential equations to at the smallest might be 20 students.
Okay. Do you ever try to figure out kind of at the individual level kind of what gets each student going? Because you could imagine this semester I happen to have a mix that's like really into applications, and I'm going to spend more energy on applications.
I would say I rarely do that with my undergraduate teaching. With my PhD advising, I always do that.
Right, right.
There, it's such an intimate relationship where you're working with a student for 3 or 4 or 5 or sometimes 6 years.
Right.
You do get to know their strengths and weaknesses and tastes. And like for instance, right now I have a student who loves to make a mess. He will try everything, and it's wrong, and he sees what's wrong, and he fixes it.
Yeah.
And I have other students who are very tight and don't want to show you anything until it's correct.
Right.
And the way I would approach those students is very different.
Very different, right. I do feel like, in some sense, we're like leaving something on the table here, where if we could measure kind of what kinds of students people are, we could kind of custom. I mean, it's hard in a lecture; it's very hard.
Yeah.
But in the assignments, in kind of what we ask students to do outside of class, even what we ask them to do in class, if we ask them to do things, there's kind of gains to be had from customizing it to the individual student.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen no one even try to do this.
Yeah, I honestly can't say that I've tried to do that in undergraduate classes, even as small as 20. The reality is that the way that things operate here, not just here at Cornell, but places I've taught before, it's rare that I would know those 20 students well enough to be able to even think about the question of how to customize it for each one.
Right. This was
just not in the nature of you just don't get to know them well enough. Now, in my
inquiry-based
classes, I do. I mean, the class I taught this semester, one of the two classes I taught, I had the students on the first day write their mathematical autobiography.
Nice.
And they submit a very informal reminiscence of who were the teachers who helped shape them to either love or hate math. Who do they remember? What were their aversive experiences, their very positive experiences? Just tell stories.
How many students?
That class had 30, actually this semester, 40 students.
Okay.
Yeah, 40 students. And it's in response to a requirement that Cornell has called the math and quantitative reasoning requirement, which is to say that everyone has to take some minimal level of math or statistics to graduate. And many students already satisfy that by taking calculus or statistics, right, just for their major or because they're interested. But there are people who are, you know, in history of art or politics or whatever, and they're not interested in math at all. They thought they were done with it in high school.
Right.
They get here, they find they still have to take one more course.
Right.
They end up taking my course.
Right.
And so it's interesting, you know, what do you do with them? Do you say, well, this is your chance to learn algebra properly, finally.
Oh, boy.
You know, there are many schools that give a remedial college algebra course. What we do is very different, and I think it succeeds in the sense that the students finish by having a real appreciation of what math is, I would say for the first time in their life, and actually liking it and seeing why some people might love it.
This is, in some sense, the toughest audience you could possibly imagine for a math class.
Yeah.
And so do you use this kind of scattershot, throw everything against the wall and see what works? Or for this kind of a group, do you have a specific set of things that you try?
Yeah, this class is done with a very particular philosophy that I've been experimenting with now for a few years, two or three years.
How many times have you
taught it? I've only taught it twice.
Okay.
So I taught it 2 years ago and then just recently, just a few days ago. And so the style is, in the jargon, inquiry-based learning.
Okay.
And what that means is that I have the students sit at tables of about 4 to 6 students at a table. There is never a lecture at all. I don't answer questions.
Really?
I play the game of a psychiatrist. You ask me a question, I ask you a question.
Wow.
But I hope not in a too obnoxious way. The goal is that you can figure things out. Right. And it's okay to be confused. In fact, that's part of the nature of the mathematical enterprise. Of course you're going to be confused and struggling. Now you're doing honest math.
So you must know David Easley.
Sure, I know David Easley.
Okay, so David was on the podcast in our last episode, or 2 episodes ago. And he said, so he described this as a pure Socratic class.
Uh-huh.
And he said that he experienced this in graduate school and that when he tried to teach it, it didn't go well. And in fact, he did it with a graduate level class where he refused to answer questions. He would only answer questions with questions.
Yeah.
But it was not successful in the sense that he had a lot of students crying.
Yeah. Well, the teacher in a class like this needs to know how to play.
Right.
And I didn't know how until I was shown by colleagues from Westfield State who have developed a series that's called Discovering the Art of Mathematics, where the word art is to be underlined.
Right.
This is math for liberal arts students.
Right.
And you can find Discovering the Art of Mathematics on the web. They have produced on the order of 10 or 11 free books on dance, music, infinity, all about the math of dance or music or infinity or patterns or whatever, very attractive subjects. And the books are full of activities that can be done in a 1-hour class or an hour and a half that are very open-ended, but also sort of carefully pedagogically crafted to produce a maximum aha moment.
So give us an example.
Well, on the first day, I pass out a piece of paper with a square drawn in the middle of it. And the students are each given the square in the middle of the paper and scissors. So they, you know, like this is sort of like Montessori for little kids, except these are college students.
Yep.
And then I ask them, using your scissors, make a single cut in a straight line that cuts out the square. Now, that at first sounds ridiculous because, you know, to cut out a square, you have to cut on the side and then make a corner and go around. And you can't do it in a single straight cut. So you might think it's impossible.
Unless you fold.
Ah, very good. Unless you fold. So some student somewhere in the room will say, "What are we allowed to fold the paper?" And then you can say, go ahead.
You answer the question.
Yeah, sure.
That question you can answer.
That question you can answer. What are the rules? So,
right.
So now the students start holding up the paper, you know, to the ceiling, and they're looking at the lines, you know, as they fold to see, they want to make the lines line on top of each other.
Yeah.
And with a square, it's pretty easy.
Yeah.
You can do it so that you can make one cut and the square will fall out of the middle of the paper.
Nice.
Okay, so everybody is happy. They just did something that worked.
Yeah.
But it was a little tricky. They had to think about it at first. They didn't. Okay, then you give them an equilateral triangle and everybody can do that. Give them a rectangle. That's a little harder. There are two ways to do it. The obvious things that you might think don't necessarily work, and people cut out some shapes that aren't, you know, that have funny cuts where there shouldn't be cuts and so on. And then you just silently give them another piece of paper with the same rectangle. Anyway, when it gets to a scalene triangle, meaning a triangle where the three sides are all different length, that doesn't, it's hard. That one is hard. I should say, it's not like the class is silent. There's a lot of buzz in the room. People are laughing at their mistakes. They're helping each other. But, you know, we also talk. Like, I'll say, what things were confusing about the, say, the equilateral triangle, or what worked? And then someone will say something like, I noticed that if I folded the angle in half, you know, that is, if I used the symmetry, then I could get the two sides to line on top of each other, and then I could cut. So then someone would say, yeah, so we can only do symmetrical shapes. Like, you could ask, what do you wonder about when you see this?
Yep.
And when you show them the scalene triangle where there's no symmetry, some people say, I think this is impossible.
Uh-huh.
And that's what you're trying to teach us, that this only works for symmetrical shapes. And I won't answer that.
Right.
I'll say, so, I mean, I might say something like, maybe you should figure out an argument why it's impossible.
Right.
Can you come up with a proof that it's impossible?
And then that's much harder.
That would be hard, but maybe that's where this is going. But then other people are busy folding and not, you know, thinking too deeply, and then they get it to work. That is, they find a way to cut it out, and everyone's like, whoa, what did you do, dude?
Right, interesting.
Anyway, so the class is really interesting and fun to teach, and by the end of the hour, most students have not managed to do the scalene triangle, and so they're just told to go home and fool around with it over the weekend. And
if you can't figure it out,
it's okay. You can come back and we'll work on it next time. There's no rush. We're not going anywhere.
You don't suggest they drop the class? They don't have any? You're not in the top 20%. I'm sorry.
The beauty of this class is that there is no... This is a terminal math class. This is the last math class they're ever going to take.
Right.
Except it turns out some of them get so excited that they want to take more.
Yeah.
Okay. But a lot of them are seniors who have been putting this off as long as possible.
Right.
And so they're never going to take math again. But they're told, like, if we don't cover something, it doesn't matter.
But what do you do when your colleagues say, this class is a joke, they're not actually learning any math?
Yeah. Well, those people are wrong. They should just come to the class and watch, because what they'll see is that, for instance, I do another class where the students stand up and you and I are facing each other. And the instruction is, okay, if I put up my right hand, you have to mirror that.
Yeah.
So you'll put up your left hand and we're facing each other with mirror symmetry. We're going to do a class about symmetry, except using our bodies. So now I ask you to be in 180-degree rotational symmetry to me. Like, if I walked over to where you are and rotated 180 degrees and now faced my original self. Well, now, when my right hand is up, your right hand will be up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's different from reflectional symmetry.
Yeah.
Now I could ask, what if we have three people standing in a line where I'm in mirror symmetry to you, but the person behind you, the third person, is in 180-degree rotational symmetry.
Mm.
What's my relation to that third person? That is, if in the jargon, if I compose a mirror symmetry with a rotational symmetry, what will I get? And we can just do it with our bodies. We can Now, there are people who talk about embodied learning. That is, you have to feel it in your physical body.
And
for some students, this is the first time that math feels palpable. Because they're doing it with their actual self.
So,
but can so, I say, yeah. This is math. We're teaching group theory.
Well, so this
Do
is
you recognize this is the beginning of abstract algebra.
So each of these exercises that you have them do, is there a mapping from what they've done to symbols that would be kind of conventionally interpreted?
Not necessarily. No, there may or may not be symbols. I mean, in this case, with the symmetries being composed.
Well, it's group theory. That's all symbols.
It begins group theory.
At least that's how I think
that's how it's usually thought of.
Right.
But in fact, it's a study of symmetry. And if you, but it turns out that by the end of this activity, the students are writing down what would be called the group multiplication table for the symmetries of, you know, these different operations composed. Like, for instance, if you do a 180-degree rotation followed by another 180-degree rotation.
It's identity, right?
That's the identity. So then R squared is I. You know, you've done R composed with R. The two rotations make
right.
the identity.
Right.
So I have them write out the multiplication table,
yeah.
and they start to observe patterns in it.
Do you ever say you did it?
Yeah, sure.
And so, like, now you're doing group theory, and so here, let me show you. Here's like an advanced group theory textbook. I'm going to open it up and then
yes.
see this right here.
That
we just did this.
The students find that very gratifying.
Yeah.
So I don't want to be doctrinaire about the idea of not answering questions.
Right.
That is, sometimes it's a great relief to the students to give them mini lectures about something or to say, what you're doing now is what elementary particle physicists do when they're
right.
trying to classify quarks.
Right.
They're looking for patterns that are basically group theoretic patterns.
Right.
And
right.
you know, this has changed the world, except what you're doing is the beginning of it.
Right.
And yeah, they like that, but that's the default mode. They're used to that.
Yeah.
And we don't do too much of that. I want to show them that yeah. they can do things on their own. They can discover things and that it's perfectly okay to be stumped. Like I say, with that example with the folding paper
yeah.
and cutting out these irregular shapes, there are students who really get stymied and feel frustrated, and the class is very psychologically oriented. There's a lot of – see, this is what David Easley or his teacher may have mm-hmm. done wrong. If you're a cold fish teaching Socratic style,
right.
they're going to want to do to you what they did to Socrates. You know, here, drink to hemlock. You know, that doesn't work. What you have to do is be very empathic and say –
Yeah.
It's perfectly good to feel frustrated. All mathematicians feel frustrated
right.
90% of the time. Our default
right.
mode is that we're stuck. And you got to get through that. That's what it is to make a real discovery or to solve a problem.
Right. It has to feel normal and
yeah.
not miserable. Like
right.
stuck does not equal miserable.
No. Stuck right. is the baseline. And we're going to talk about what you do when you're stuck.
Right.
Like you
right.
can change the problem.
Right.
You have freedom in math. You can
right.
try to do an easier problem, and maybe it'll give you guidance.
Right.
Or you
right.
can
right.
work with someone else who might have an idea.
It's
or
so funny.
Can,
it's
yeah,
so funny
because
I teach something entirely different. Right now I'm teaching screenwriting online. And one of the things I'm trying to give the students, I mean, we're teaching problem solving, is you have to keep moving forwards. You can't be stuck. You know, you have to be
mm-hmm.
able to recognize when you're stuck, and you're stuck in writing something when you just keep writing the same thing and you can't figure out how to change it.
Yep.
And so I will sometimes frame to the student, well, we've learned about 8 different techniques for getting unstuck, because if you're stuck, you don't make any progress. And so I think it's fascinating that, you know, math and screenwriting
are
could
so
be taught,
similar.
Could be taught the same way, I think, because they're problem solving in a way.
They are problem solving. Exactly. I mean,
but they're creative.
They're creative. And that's
they're
why
creative.
When you said the three words that are on the outside
right.
of the math building,
right.
creativity is one of them. We think we're in the business of creativity. Our medium is shapes and numbers and symbols.
Right.
But it's the same at heart as what a musician has to wrestle with when the composition isn't coming out right.
Right.
Or a screenwriter has to deal with when the third act, you know, isn't making sense.
You got it.
So you're teaching differential equations. And you're at chapter 3 of the book, and it's we're going to learn how to solve this particular class of differential equations, and here are the methods, and you need to know how to apply these methods. There's nothing creative there.
Well, that's a very knuckleheaded way to teach differential equations.
But that is how most of the books teach
yeah, I know.
Teach the subject.
Well, fine. They don't know what they're doing.
Okay, how do you take a because at the end of the day the goal is the same, whether you're doing it through a knuckleheaded method or an inquiry-based method or some other method, The goal is to take students that don't know how to solve this set of problems, and by the end, they should know how to solve those
that's
kinds
one,
of problems.
That's, I don't know, is that the goal? That is the goal of the industrial, that's the goal of the assembly line model of education.
Yeah, okay.
That we take a, you know, the student is the widget, you know, yeah. And by the time that they fall off the end of the assembly line, they're now yeah. a knowledgeable widget.
Well, then they've acquired these skills that allow them to be more efficient parts of the production process.
I don't like that model. I mean, yes, I want them to be competent.
I don't know. I think of that as like the archetypal, at least when I took it, it was the archetypal skills class.
We have to remember that curiosity and desire are part of learning. If students want to learn, it helps.
Right. So there's this difference. So you need motivation.
Yeah.
Because in order to learn, you have to like plug away and it's hard.
Yeah.
And you can intrinsically motivate them, which you and I are on the same page about. Like I really believe in intrinsic motivation. Like students work much harder and they make much more progress when they're trying to solve it because they want to know the answer.
Sure.
As opposed to, you better do your problem set because it's 20% of your grade. And if you fail the class, you're never going to get
that
a job.
That is the motivation that a lot of our students have been fed exclusively.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think like it's hugely beneficial to
okay, but was your question, that. Given that they're motivated now for whatever reason, what's the technique of teaching differential equations?
No, it's
what is the question?
Like if I was going to teach differential equations, I would say I would have the same goal as somebody who was, like, I want them to learn how to solve these problems.
Yes,
and
so do I.
Instead of just saying, you will learn these problems and you will do these problem sets because they're this much your grade and you will study hard because you want to pass the test, I use that intrinsic motivation as a tool to get me to that same end point. Whereas I think you feel like, and this makes a lot of sense, that the goal is not necessarily just teaching them the skills, it's getting them excited. That's a goal in and of itself.
That is a goal in and of itself. But I don't want to sound too touchy-feely about this because I'm disappointed.
Too late.
Maybe I better push back on this other aspect of teaching, because when I initially said I was unhappy that 80% of my students can't do what I want them to do, that really bothers me.
Right.
And that's what's led me to explore these other attempts I'm not just lecturing, but trying something more active. Because if I speak about it introspectively, like if I think, how did I become the world-class mathematician that I am? And how did my colleagues, who are also world-class mathematicians, all of us spent the proverbial 10,000 hours working on math problems and solving them.
Yeah.
And okay, I'm not trying to make my students become Ivy League math professors.
You're setting yourself up.
Okay, fine. But if I just want them to be able to do really well on the MCAT or to, you know, the GREs or to the bridge won't collapse when they build it, you know, or they give the right amount of chemotherapy to their patients, which are all math problems.
I mean, I was thinking you want them to look at the world differently.
Okay, or if I want them to look at the world occasionally through mathematical eyes or to understand when politicians are lying to them or, you know, why.
Or even why a
well-intentioned person like Bernie Sanders is making a mistake when he says millionaires and billionaires, that he makes it sound like those are comparable.
Right.
And there's such an enormous difference between a millionaire and a billionaire. By the way, that one I like to illustrate by saying that if you ask people, how long is a million seconds? What's your gut instinct for how long a million seconds is? Do you have any visceral feel? I mean, it turns out it's 11 days.
Wow.
But if you ask what's a billion seconds, that's 32 years.
Wow.
Okay, so you have a feeling. One of them is like a big fraction of your lifetime, and one of them is, you know, what you did 2 weeks ago.
Right.
So,
I like that.
That one. But so what's going on there? I mean, if you think about that as a teaching technique, okay, we just did something concrete.
Yeah.
How do we help students understand orders of magnitude? Now, that's an elementary school topic, or really middle school or something. The secret to that one, why it produces such a big reaction in people, is because it's about you. I phrased it in a way that relates to your life. 2 weeks versus 32 years. You know what that means instinctively because that's part of your life.
Right.
Whereas if it's about, you know, writing down numbers of zeros on paper, that doesn't. And you know, we even talk about trillions now.
Right.
When we start to talk about the debt. That's 32,000 years ago. What does that mean?
Right.
You know, that's like.
That might as well be a million years ago.
Yeah. No, right. That one is very hard to think about.
Yeah.
Let's see. What's the oldest recorded history? How long ago is that? That's not 32,000 years ago.
I don't think. Well, I mean, the cave drawings?
No. We're thought to have domesticated dogs about 10 to 15,000 years ago. So we started to live with dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a long time ago. I think, when are we walking out of Africa? Is that like 100,000 years ago? I don't know. Anyway, the point is that these orders of magnitude questions are made easier by thinking about them in your own terms.
Right.
Okay. But anyway, back to the question about teaching differential equations. You know, there's little tactical things. I like to show students the common pitfalls. Mm-hmm. Don't just show them what's right. Show them what's wrong.
Right.
Because people often have ideas about how to do problems that are wrong, and you have to kind of go in there like a cancer surgeon and dig out the tumors.
I find that this is like a case where
there are misconceptions, right? That is, many people have intuitive ideas about physics or math that are just wrong. And if you just try to teach the correct thing on top of them,
that doesn't work.
You've got to get in there and figure out what are they actually thinking first before you show them what's right.
And telling is much less effective than showing. So if you can show them that, well, if you think this is true, then well, and you think this is a reasonable kind of deduction, well, then you must think this is true, which is obviously ridiculous.
Yeah, a perfect example of that would be my own childhood self when I didn't know about the restriction against dividing by zero.
Mm-hmm.
That is, at the time, I can remember it distinctly because I was embarrassed about it, that I think it was seventh grade, and I had never been taught that you can't divide by zero. And there was some question like, I don't know, 3 divided by zero. And I thought the answer was zero, which is what a lot of people assume.
Right.
And my friend, George Gashgarian, who somehow knew about this, said, no, that's absurd because that would mean 0 times 0 equals 3.
Right.
You know, just like 6 divided by 2 is 3 means 3 times 2 is 6. He just explained it to me. The reason you can't divide by zero is it would imply weird things like, I mean, the answer can't be zero because 0 times 0 doesn't give you anything but 0. Anyway.
But this idea that like things that mathematical expressions that look like they don't make sense, like 3 divided by 0, that we can actually assign values to them, that like 0 factorial.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Like why is 0 factorial 1?
That's a nice one.
Because 10, okay, so 3, just for our less mathematical listeners, 3 factorial is 1 times 2 times 3. And 2 factorial is just 1 times 2. You add it up, all the numbers from 1 up until you get that number. But 0 factorial, well, it turns out that if you just define 0 factorial, you say, I know you can't, it's not 1 going all the way up to 0, it doesn't make any sense. But if we just say it's 1, all these things just kind of like work out nicely.
Yeah, that's a great example because that illustrates something that mathematicians do all the time, but that needs comment. If you don't comment on it, students may not get it, which what's being illustrated there is that the rules about factorials that work very intuitively when you do 1 factorial or 2 factorial or 3 factorial, as you play with those, you start to notice a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And this pattern is a more abstract thing than the original multiplications, which is that if I have a number like 6 factorial and then I want to go to the next number, 7 factorial, it'll just be 7 times the previous number, 6 factorial.
Yeah.
So when you start to learn this pattern that n times n minus 1 factorial equals n factorial, that's the pattern we're talking about. If you want to keep extending that pattern,
so -1 factorial,
you can
start
extending it down to numbers like 0 factorial.
Right.
The pattern doesn't explain what you should do with in-between numbers, like a half factorial.
Right.
There's a different pattern that extends to that. And so this is a game that we're in, that we try to find patterns from simple things.
Yeah.
And then out of an aesthetic choice, I mean, this is another thing people don't realize, that in math, you're free to do whatever you want. you're an artist who can make choices because they're beautiful.
Right.
We can define what zero factorial is to make it the maximally beautiful choice.
Right.
And that's what really where it comes from. It keeps the pattern good. This is related to another thing that students rarely understand, including their teachers rarely understand it too. Why is a negative times a negative a positive? Right? We were all taught this. Negative one times negative one is positive one.
Right.
Why is that true? And if you think about, you know, if you think of, first of all, a lot of people don't even really believe in negative numbers.
Right.
Because you can't hold negative.
Well, economists can't do because debts are very.
Yeah, that's right. There's intuition in economics for it. But anyway, the reason why negative times negative is positive is another one of these aesthetic choices.
It just works out nicely.
It works out better because then the distributive law that you're all brainwashed about, you know, but you never know why am I learning about the distributive law. The distributive law then works for negative numbers as well as positive numbers, yeah. If you make that definition.
Yeah.
And so it's just a way of changing as few things as possible when you expand the universe of numbers.
So let me ask you a question. This is kind of the way I think about things, and maybe you can tell me it's just wrong, but I think of I can teach classes as very analytical. Here's a problem. Your job is to solve it. Mm-hmm. Or I can teach things as creative. But the more I think about it, the more I think there's a lot of gray in there. Mm-hmm. Because I can give you kind of more open-ended problems that you have to solve, but you have to be very creative in order to solve them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think about it more as a continuum now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think classes like differential equations, they're traditionally taught very analytically.
Yeah.
Here's a set of problems. Here's a set of like kind of cookie cutter ways to solve those problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think classes that are very skewed on like this analytical recipe style tend to be boring.
They may be. It can work to teach in that way if the students are already committed to the subject.
Yeah,
like
okay.
If you're teaching differential equations to physicists who need that
they know they're going to use this
for Maxwell's equations in electricity and magnetism or for quantum mechanics, they're just intrinsically motivated. Presumably they love physics and they know I've just got to get this under my belt.
Right.
So you can get away with it there. And but there are other classes where, you know, if it's calculus for life sciences.
Well, no. You don't have to go any farther because I have the personal experience. I was a computer science major at a school where differential equations was a major requirement.
Uh-huh.
And I knew that I was pretty sure I was never going to use it again in my life.
Yeah.
And all the examples were these physics examples that I was not interested in at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a good experience for me.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're not alone. This does happen.
Right.
But even within the, the point you were raising is there's a sort of way of emphasizing creativity versus learning the cookbook.
So do you do that in your, when you teach these kind of more traditional classes like complex analysis, how do you kind of insert more creativity in the class than textbook?
Yeah, one thing you can do is, like say complex analysis, the foundational theorem is something called Cauchy's theorem.
Mm-hmm.
And then many other theorems flow from that one. So Cauchy's theorem, it turns out, has at least three different very nice proofs. And just showing the contrast of what you get in terms of insight from each of those three is a way of bringing out the creative dimension. That is, there's not one right way of proving this. There are at least three good ways, and probably tomorrow somebody could discover a fourth.
Right.
That is, the fact is that Cauchy's theorem is true.
Yes.
There's nothing, you know, wishy-washy about that. But how you deduce it leaves a lot of room for creativity.
Yeah,
and,
interesting.
You know, I'm not going to expect my students to come up with a new proof of it. That's not reasonable.
Well, that's showing them that there's like this beauty in this interesting way. I guess I'm getting to this other piece, which is outside, when you give assignments,
mm-hmm.
do you give assignments that where there's room for them to kind of breathe and like play around?
Sure. I mean, like in the case of differential equations, you can ask, solve this problem analytically using formulas,
mm-hmm.
which is the way you were taught.
Yep.
You can also say, try to solve it geometrically, where you would draw a picture that contains most of the same information but can be done with a lot of intuition and uses very little apparatus That right. is, it's just a matter of sketching, understanding what the differential equation is saying. You can draw the behavior of the solution without even knowing the formula.
You know, it's really interesting. I had that same experience this semester teaching probability and statistics. Mm-hmm. There are lots of cases where you've got these two random processes and they're kind of related, mm-hmm. and you want to know what's the probability that, like, two people, they're showing up at a bookstore and they're friends. And the one is going to show up kind of around 1:30 and the other is going to show up kind of around 2:30. Mm-hmm. What are the chances that they run into each other? Because mm-hmm. they're only going to stay there for about 15 minutes.
Okay.
And you've got, there's like the grinded out way where you're setting up these double integrals and like you're figuring out bounds and integrating the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then there's the, let's draw a picture and see where things overlap. And you can do it entirely kind of visually.
So let me see if I understand your question. Was it that each person you gave a specified mean, you're going to use normal distributions?
Well,
like, was that
the
idea?
Problem I gave them was uniform.
Oh, two uniform distributions.
Right.
Okay, I see.
They're going to show up sometime between 1:30 and 2.
Yeah.
The one person and the other person are going to show up sometime between 1:45 and 2:15.
Oh, okay.
And what are the chances that they run into each other?
So then,
And it's one of these problems where it sounds so simple and you just lay it out there.
Uh-huh.
But it's actually, if you're going to kind of apply the machinery,
yes,
it's actually quite a long problem to solve. It's actually mm-hmm. Surprisingly difficult.
I mean, I think one of the running themes here, sometimes I like to look back to Piaget, where he saw kind of human cognitive development. We start off, you know, doing things as sensory motor ways, and then we move to a kind of concrete, a frame where things are just things. And finally, we get to kind of a formal level where we deal with symbols. And in higher ed, a lot of times, we're like, okay, we're up here at the level of abstractions and symbols. We're just going to stay there. And I mean, a lot of, I think what we're talking about is getting the sensory motor back and the concrete back, including doing things and picturing. And, you know, that example about a piece of paper and cutting or, standing and kind of moving and, in symmetrical ways, it really shows that very concrete things can have very abstract kind of meanings, or even sensory motor actions can have this kind of symbolic dimension. Because we are, once you're 16 or whatever, you can deal with abstractions. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me such a rich way of doing this, of teaching and helping people learn.
I'm glad you think so. I use this a lot. Actually, one of the questions that Doug had asked me to think about before we sat down today was, suppose you were going to teach a concept in linear algebra called eigenvalues and eigenvectors. And how would I approach something like that? And as I thought about it a little bit before coming into the studio, it fits exactly what you were saying, Edward, that that it has this sensory motor side and building up to an abstract side, which is one way I like to think about eigenvalues and eigenvectors is imagine your body again. Where your heart will represent the origin of a coordinate system. And you can stick your arm out to the side, stick out your right arm. That's a vector. You could also stick out your left arm to the other side. Now you look like a T. You know, that's another vector. And now if you just turned around standing, you know, like a ballerina and just turn 90 degrees or something, you ask, like in those dieting photographs of someone before and after, or the hair club for men. You could ask, let's compare before and after, the position of your body before and after the 90-degree rotation, and ask which of your vectors have moved and which are in the same place that they used to be in. That is, your arm that was sticking out is still sticking out, but it's now 90 degrees away from where it was. However, the axis that your body just spun around, that is your vertical axis. You were spinning around your vertical axis like a ballerina. That axis did not move, right? That's still vertical. And so, in fact, what you've just done, if you ask what thing is unchanged from before to after, it's your vertical axis, your rotation axis.
That's the eigenvector?
That's the eigenvector of the rotation.
So you...
Were you 25 years ago?
So you teach math using motor and pictorial
methods. That's the start.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the start. So now that I've got you thinking that what an eigenvector is, it's a vector that doesn't change its direction after a transformation. This was a very special kind of eigenvector in that it had an eigenvalue of 1. That is, the axis didn't get longer or shorter. It stayed the same length. The rotation didn't make it longer. Mm-hmm. It didn't stretch it or compress it. And so this, in the jargon, would have an eigenvalue of 1, which is the stretch factor. It didn't stretch. So, but now, you know, if I want to say that this is something important in the real world, how about the example of the billion-dollar eigenvector, where if you now think about the problem that was a very big problem in the mid-1990s of returning good answers to search queries. You're on the web. You want to find the best place to buy something, or you want to find the most authoritative source about differential equations. You would type into the old thing called AltaVista. And it, you remember AltaVista?
I remember.
And it would return a lot of answers, but most of them weren't that good.
Right.
But now, with Google, you pretty much get what you want every time.
It's amazing.
Well, Google is based on eigenvectors. The big idea of Google was that if you had a map of the World Wide Web, you could say which pages were important because they're pointed to by other important pages.
More times.
Except that now you realize that that's a circular definition.
Right.
How do you assign importance to pages? And the intuition is important pages are pointed to by other important pages, as you say, many times. If you translate that into math, you end up getting an equation that says, let's assign importance to all pages at random.
Yep.
Well, that's their before. Now, let's say your new importance is the sum of the importances of the pages that point to you. That's your after.
Right.
And if you look at the relationship between before and after, before was a big list of the importances of all the pages. That big list is a vector. The after is a vector of the importances after everything gets added. And the point is that if everything is done correctly, before must equal after. That's the self-consistently correct definition of pages importance, right, which in the jargon is their page rank. So anyway, this is an eigenvector problem. And by solving the eigenvector problem, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, you know, made this multi-billion dollar company.
Right.
So anyway, eigenvectors are big business, as well as, you know, I hope between the ballerina and the
There you go. You got the application.
Yeah.
You got the physical and you got the financial.
Yeah, now if you want to, now I think a student is motivated to see how do I actually calculate
something. See, this is actually really interesting. This is like a very efficient 3-minute way of hitting like the several different motivations that
you're
saying.
Well, that's why I'm interested in teaching. I mean, this is the creative side of teaching.
Right.
How do you come up with stuff like this?
That's right.
Well, I like to think about things like
That's right.
So we're almost at time.
Yes. We always close the show the same way.
Oh.
We ask our guests, sometimes we warn them, and in this case I did warn you, but we always ask our guests to tell us about a time they made a mistake in teaching a class. It can be in the classroom, it can be outside the classroom, and what they learned from it. Everyone makes mistakes.
Sure. There's one very fresh in my mind because it's just happened in the past few days.
See, this is the thing. Even the best teachers, they don't stop making mistakes.
Oh, no.
They keep pushing the envelope and making new mistakes.
Well, so the question with this inquiry-based class that I talked about is I have to assign grades.
Yes.
How am I going to assign grades to a class that involves cutting, you know, triangles out of paper?
Do you give exams?
I don't give exams. I feel like exams are just going to activate the student's math anxiety.
Exactly.
You could say, so what? Go ahead and activate it. They're there to learn math.
How else are you going to rank them?
I want to do other things. I want to treat this like an architecture class or where they're going to keep a portfolio of their creative ideas, the things they wondered about, the things they solved, the things they were confused about.
I
ask them to reflect on what they've done in class and what they're still wondering about, and also to go out and learn things by searching on the web or talking to friends or sitting down and solving the problems they couldn't solve in class. All that goes into their Leonardo da Vinci portfolio.
I love this idea.
Okay, so that's one way. Another way is I have them make posters about contemporary mathematicians, which they are told, you know, what the criteria are for a good poster. And then they display posters, and they also evaluate each other's posters. And so do we, the teaching staff. And there's also participation. How did they contribute in class, either by talking or maybe by asking good questions or just by listening and being a good team player? I'm watching them.
But after every class, are you writing down this person asked?
No, I'm not very good at assessment. That you asked me what's my mistake. My mistake is I'm so fixated on trying to get them to love math and think about the things that I care about,
yeah,
and not this, what to me is a frankly not very interesting job of assessment.
TAs are for.
My TA drank from the same Kool-Aid as I did. So neither of us was giving enough specific feedback to the students about what do we want in their portfolios. Uh-huh. And the reason is because I don't know what I want.
Right.
I want them to surprise me. I want them to take this to new places. I know what I want in their hearts. I want them to do something imaginative.
Right.
But how do I judge that? And also, how do I tell them this? I mean, anyway, the point is, I don't feel I did a good enough job. And I've had a few grade grubbing students complaining that I got an A minus and I don't know why I didn't get an A.
Oh.
And I think in the future, I'm going to try to be more specific about what I want.
Yeah, and that's right. Right.
I don't think this is going to solve it, but I think I didn't do a good enough job there.
But you need some sort of rubric.
Yeah.
Some sort of like lists. And what you don't want is the students looking at the rubric to decide what they're going to put in their portfolio. You want them like putting together their portfolio and then making sure that they've like everything.
So I had two relevant experiences recently. One was in the class I'm teaching, I decided I would ask students at the beginning, what is your goal for this class? What do you want to learn? And the other is I helped a professor develop a rubric for grading. And what he wanted to grade was, how much progress have you made?
Mm-hmm.
Not did you achieve a certain, you know, did you learn this concept to a certain degree? So it would be interesting to think about the problems grading them, for instance, in terms of goals or progress rather than in some, you know, a fairly arbitrary yardstick.
Mm-hmm. That's nice. That's interesting. That may be a good help for me in the future. I mean, in particular, I didn't want to grade them on their math knowledge because
I have
people there who are, some are very sophisticated mathematically and want to do math explorations, and some are just taking the requirement so they can graduate.
It's like you need to take where they started as a...
Yeah. No, your solution, Edward, would address that in both ways. What are their goals and then how much progress did they make toward their goal?
That experience of struggle thing would be a good thing too. I think you might have three yardsticks, and one is did you challenge yourself, and another is did you achieve what you set out to, and I've forgotten the third.
That's nice.
That's great.
Except who assigns the grade? Do I work with them to assign the grade? Some people do that. They actually have the student suggest a grade and defend it.
Right, exactly.
That scares the heck out of me.
I've never done that, but it's interesting to think about.
That scares the heck out of me because I think you've got some students who are just humble and other students who are arrogant.
Yes.
Well, sometimes I think the A student would always give themselves an A minus and the B plus student gives themselves an A, you know, it's par for the course.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know what approach would you take on that as far as, if you're going to assess in that way?
I have, the only relevant thing I did was sometimes ask students to kind of vote on each other's work in terms of a grade. That was more kind of a set of standards. And I actually found that the students were usually right. I thought they were kind of always right in which other student work was better. Mm-hmm. And initially I just thought, oh my God, they're going to just vote for their friends. But they could have two votes. And I thought, well, one would be a friend and one would be real. And the votes I actually kind of ended up working out. But I think you'd have to ask them their goals before you told them they were going to grade them on it so they didn't set the mark too close.
Right.
Anyway, that's a work in progress. I plan to teach the course in the future, and I'm not sure what to do about it. But as far as their attitudes towards math, that has changed a lot. And so if my colleagues, you know, think that the students aren't learning any math, I would say up till this point, most of them have never done any math, period.
Right.
They've just been good citizens regurgitating what they were told. Here, they're actually having a genuine mathematical experience of struggle and occasional triumph.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Thanks,
guys. This was great fun.
Conversation.
Really fun.
Very inspiring.
All right.
Until next time.
Yeah.
That's all for this episode of the Teach Better podcast. If you want more, you can visit our website at teachbetter.co, where you'll find all our old episodes. Thanks for listening.